Welcome to The Leading Tone, a podcast that explores all aspects of all types of music. Today we discuss film composers. I'm Fernando.
And I'm Alex, and welcome to The Leading Tone podcast. So we're starting with John Williams, right?
Yep, we are.
We are actually starting with John Williams, but let's talk a little bit about our process for this episode first, briefly here. We each picked three film composers that we're big fans of, for a total of six composers today. This ended up being a really interesting list because I feel like we have a good bit of modern on this list, as well as a good bit of that classic sound. It's just good variety in general. This is a really fun one for me because I'm very passionate about film music. I feel like I'm listening to film music just about weekly, honestly. It's always in my rotation, whether it's John Williams or John Powell, James Newton Howard. I'm just a huge fan of a lot of different film composers. What about you, Fernando?
I don't listen to film music quite as much. I definitely circle around to it. I have my own playlist for it, but I wouldn't say it comes up as often as you listen to it.
Well, let's go ahead and get started here. So, like we said, we are going to start with John Williams. John Williams, born in 1932. He's still kicking today. He's still writing music, and he's still scheduled to write more music. He just finished up the ninth Star Wars film, and I think that his Star Wars scores have gotten better, actually, over the years since the 70s, but we'll talk about that as we keep going. A little bit of background on John Williams. So he served in the U.S. Air Force Band from 1951 to 1954, did arranging in orchestration and conducting for these service bands. He studied at Juilliard, UCLA. While he's at Juilliard, he's actually playing in the jazz clubs and the recording studios, and you can definitely hear some of that influence on some of his scores. But 1956, he becomes a studio pianist for Hollywood. This kind of leads to his breakthrough to get into Hollywood music a little bit more, and then he starts to do scores for disaster films. And then before his famous partnership with Steven Spielberg, that he had a lot of really successful films with, he did some really interesting scores that I want to talk about, because we talk a lot about his Star Wars and his Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones. But before Spielberg, in the early 70s, there is one score that stood out to me in particular that I hadn't really heard before I was doing my research, and that is a score for Jane Eyre. This score really captures the essence of Vaughan Williams and Holst and Elgar. Elgar in particular, because that's actually one of his biggest influences as a composer, actually, which surprised me at first, but the more I listened and the more I became acclimated with Elgar's music, I started to see it, even in Star Wars, and a lot of these. But
interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so Jane Eyre was one that I just showed Fernando. A lot of British influence. The Cowboys is another one that I'm a huge fan of. This one is a little bit more in the vein of some of his scores that employ more of the leitmotif that he's famous for. Because obviously, Star Wars, he's so famous for his character themes and his space themes and themes that convey something. And so he's following in that Wagnerian tradition. I don't know if you want to speak to that some, Fernando, before we get to some of these other scores.
Well, I think it's just so apparent, the idea that he's always trying to get across, which is what is so great about his composing. Like, the idea is super clear all the time, where he's trying to portray a certain thing and you know exactly what's going to happen, what that thing is, you know, what the seams on the dress look like, that kind of, you know, that kind of detail within the music that gives you the overall effect that you need for a movie or film, like some of those early ones, and even into the Spielberg ones.
Well, even with just Jane Eyre and the Cowboys, I feel like I can picture those scenes so intimately, and I have not seen either of those movies. I've heard the Cowboys is actually kind of a bad movie.
Oh, really?
But from what I've heard, Jane Eyre is a pretty solid motion picture.
One we'll have to check out.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just such beautiful music, and I'm picturing really pastoral green everywhere with Jane Eyre, just really beautiful British countryside. That is absolutely what I'm picturing when I'm listening to that score. So then his famous partnership with Steven Spielberg, which is still going on today. He's scheduled to score the latest in the Indiana Jones films. I don't really know how that's going to turn out.
There's, yeah, I didn't even know there was a new one coming out.
Harrison Ford is cast in it. Oh, wow. So Harrison Ford, John Williams, and Spielberg, they've been in the business for a long time. So he starts with Sugarland Express in 74. That's a cool score. I listened to a little bit of that. Haven't seen the movie. Jaws, very, very famous score. There's a lot of depth to this one that... besides just the shark theme, right? Yeah. Everybody knows it, that minor second. There's the shark cage fugue in this, which is really, really impressive. And it goes to show how modern some of his writing could really be, because he wouldn't approach this sound again until he did something like the March of the Resistance in the Star Wars Force Awakens. But the fugal writing, and not only that's an really old art form in terms of music, but it's so modernly done and so cleverly done
that... yeah, blended with like very dissonant harmonies, obviously, which right. are necessary for the story of Jaws.
It's so cool to me. I'm just like, Bach didn't really picture this when he was writing his piece.
Yeah, I would definitely encourage anybody that hasn't listened to all of the Jaws soundtrack, or just when you watch, if you watch it again, just take a closer listen to the music. It is very intricate and really complex for a movie about a shark.
Right, yeah. And I mean, that's a great film that I feel like is really enhanced by the score and the quality of the score. Because if you didn't have that score, I don't know how interested I would be.
It would be nowhere near as tense.
Yeah, I think that definitely makes the movie. Steven Spielberg obviously had a vision there, but John Williams helped to further that immensely, I would say.
Mm-hmm. That's a big thing with all of the film music that we're going to talk about today, where it's all a very clear image in the music that only enhances what you're being shown visually in the films. And I think that's something that's so great about film music and the collaboration that it has with visual media,
right?
In that way.
Yeah, and we're both passionate about these storytelling mediums and film and literature particularly, so I think that this is just a fun one for us to do. It's just a cool discussion to have. So this next one, Close Encounters of the Third Kind, Fernando, you want to take the lead on this one? You were telling me stuff that I didn't even realize about this earlier.
Yeah, so it actually goes perfectly with what we just said. Like, the way that the music is incorporated into this movie is so clever because it's the main focus of the whole movie, basically. Right. The spaceship is basically, you know, making a song to communicate, and so that is used by John Williams in a way that you might not expect from a film,
especially at the
like
time.
That. Yeah, especially at the 70s. Time. Yeah, it's so well incorporated into the movie that it you don't really notice it, and a lot of the like actual soundtrack is actually very like abstract and dissonant.
You can't listen to this one as much on its own.
No, yeah, you can't listen to it as much on its own. I think there's just one track that it does kind of have that like similar kind of fugal right. stuff.
I know exactly the one you're talking about.
Yeah, but that one's really good.
That's a cool moment in the film.
It is a really cool moment in the film. So yeah, that one's a really cool one to check out. And I love the way that that everything comes together. Like we just said, the music enhances the storytelling, it enhances the visuals of the spaceship with the flashing lights, and I mean, it's necessary. The music is necessary in that film.
Right, absolutely. That's another one that would not be anywhere without its great score.
Yeah.
And so from there, John Williams just took off. I mean, throughout the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s, he's just nearly two scores a year. We'll talk about some of our highlights for sure. So we talked about Jane Eyre and the Cowboys and Jaws. Okay, I think we can talk about Star Wars now. We'll go back to some of the other facts later, but man, the character themes in the whole series are great, and they're really iconic. And I think he figured out early on how to use all of these themes in the most effective way.
Right. And so just to clarify for anybody that doesn't understand that, in Star Wars, John Williams has written a theme for a bunch of characters, if not all of the characters, the main characters. And so that's what Alex means by the, like, character themes.
Right. Yeah, right? You hear me reference that a lot throughout this.
And each one is extremely unique and does a great job of, like kind of summarizing the character into one melodic theme.
Right.
And sometimes even foreshadowing what's going to happen in their arc.
Yeah, even especially in the prequel Star Wars films, the Anakin's theme has some foreshadowing of that, that Darth Vader in there. Spoiler alert for a 20-30 year old movie, but so yeah, I just think that it's interesting with Star Wars because I feel like the characters, they're so iconic, but they're relatively one note characters. You know, they have two or three defining traits and they have events that define them, and they're all just like, oh, John Williams, like, oh, I can put this into a theme easily. And it's like, they're, whether they're adventurous, like the theme surrounding Luke, with Leia, Leia's theme is beautiful. And then there's themes to go with the Millennium Falcon, and those motifs are so iconic, and they're dummy proof. Everyone knows them if they've seen the movies, even if you've just seen a couple. It's just,
and that's
like
the thing, a lot of the times you don't even if you're not thinking musically, you're not going to notice that the that melody or that musical moment goes with a certain character, but it's a subconscious thing.
And he'll
when you're
hide
watching
it too,
the movie
sometimes.
Yeah, he'll hide it intentionally, again, sometimes foreshadowing moments of the movie before they even happen.
Right. So we'll keep talking about Star Wars throughout this, but let's talk about some of these other ones. Superman in 1978, that is such a great theme. It's such a heroic theme that kind of foreshadows what he's going to do with Indiana Jones a couple years later. That's a really, really great one. Played a lot at Pops concerts. And Star Wars Episode 5 has some really, really standout tracks for me. Yoda's theme, his character theme, is my favorite character theme in all of those films. I think when they brought Yoda, the puppet version, back in The Last Jedi, and his theme starts to slowly come in, I lost it. There were tears welling up in my eyes. I was just so, so happy to hear that theme again. There's another one, the asteroid field. This is when they're escaping from the planet Hoth, the ice planet, and the Empire is chasing Han, 3PO, and Leia in the Falcon, and the score is just so cool. There's these really clever motifs that are not used anywhere else in the score, and it's such a shame because I feel like that's one of his absolute standout chase scene tracks. It's so iconic and so cool. I really, really love that one. Indiana Jones, we talked about a little bit. What a great theme. Even just the Raiders March is just so great. I really am a huge fan of that one. E.T. is one of our all-time favorites, not only score-wise, but that I think that's just one of my favorite films.
Yeah, me too, actually. Yeah, I have a little E.T. Figure right over here,
oh,
too,
cool.
In my own room.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, E.T. is a great, great movie, and the music is perfect for that film, I think. It really encapsulates that, like, friendly sci-fi type vibe.
Right.
But then it also has the more serious moments as the movie does. And
your friendly neighborhood alien.
Right. Yeah. So I think that's a really great one. And relatively complex, but also very
tuneful.
Tuneful, friendly to the ear, you know.
Those harmonies are complex, though.
Yeah, you know, they can be.
Dense harmonies in there. The opening score when like E.T. is first like beamed down, I guess, that's like a really different kind of sound than the rest of the themes. And that glorious ending with those glorious themes stated in the French horns. I think we had one particular track that we're a huge fan of because it's just a 15-minute, it's like the last 15 minutes of the film. It's the escape, chase, and saying goodbye. And it's all of the highs, all the great chase music, all the glorious themes that you could want in there. I could not love that track anymore.
Yeah.
My high school, actually, after I graduated, they did a play-by-play where they played the music, that track, to the movie. They had the movie up on the projector, and they performed it at the concert, and the audience loved it. It was such a hit. So we could talk about E.T. for forever. But anyway, there was a couple more Star Wars films, a couple more Indiana Jones films. Home Alone. This is one we just talked about, we listened to together. And I had thought that it had this Tchaikovsky kind of sound. But Fernando actually pointed out that there's a little bit more of this Shostakovich kind of influence in there.
Right, and it's because of the humor that has to be injected into it, I think, and, you know, in the best possible way. It sounds like the way that Shostakovich would imply humor and irony, it's really just a fun... Well, there's a specific moment, and it's the way that that John Williams uses chromaticism to move from one, you know, from one section to another. There was just a specific... Tchaikovsky and Shostakovich also have, like, kind of a similar vibe. It's just Shostakovich has sometimes a little bit more angsty vibe and sometimes a little bit more tongue-in-cheek kind of way of doing things.
So it shows John Williams' sense of humor a little bit. It is, and it, that's also just a great film, and it's a film with great humor, too. So it makes sense that John Williams would be able to channel that. And just, we've discussed so much diversity with him alone with this, so I'm really excited to get through the rest of these. Jurassic Park, great themes in there. Aside even from the main theme, there's a couple others that are just really, really gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Jurassic Park, then we have Schindler's List. Complete 180, right?
Yeah.
So different from Jurassic Park and Home Alone, just so... so longing, so emotional, and really, really quite devastatingly beautiful music.
Mm-hmm.
It's really quite emotional. So many of these scores stand on their own, though. There's only been a couple, I think, that don't stand on their own as listening. Mm-hmm. There's so many tracks in John Williams' music. It's not every single track, because some of it, it's like, okay, Spielberg just wants the strings to sustain one pitch here while I do something poignant in the film or something.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he's allowed to have more of a free rein and do whatever he wants, then that's when you're getting these just great standalone tracks that are just as at home in the film as they would be in the orchestra hall.
Yeah.
Which is kind of an overarching discussion that we have in store for you today. Is this music within the orchestral music canon, right? Is it worthy alongside Beethoven and Mozart? And spoiler alert, it is. But is it really a part of the repertoire? And we'll discuss that throughout. I think that there's exceptions to it. I think some of it is obviously, yes, this is just as great and is the next evolution of the opera or the musicals that so many composers were writing for throughout the years. It's this next evolution of art, and if Mozart and Beethoven were alive today, they'd probably be doing film scores.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that, especially Mozart, he was all about cashing in. So
can you imagine Mozart and Spielberg? That might be an interesting alternate universe we got there.
Yeah,
get the fan fictions going, people. So let's talk about Saving Private Ryan, another great one. Really great themes in that. That's Hymn to the Fallen. That's where that comes from. That's a really, really gorgeous and memorious piece that's really, really quite emotional. Star Wars Episode One is an interesting one because this is one that's not that great of a movie but has some really great music. Duel of the Fates. I have nostalgia for this movie just because of Duel of the Fates.
Mm-hmm.
What a great track there. AI, Artificial Intelligence. That's one I really, really like. Have you seen that one?
I have seen that, yeah.
It's a good movie. It's a really good movie, and I think the music's pretty good in that one, too. Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. Now, Fernando and I are kind of at odds about this. I'm going to let you talk about this because I have opinions about Harry Potter.
Yeah, it's super similar to all the other John Williams film scores. I think it's great at giving you that imagery that you need for the film and to get you into the fantasy, you know, zone of being in a wizarding world. And,
the wizarding world.
And I enjoy Harry Potter in general. I like the entire franchise. You know, while it was still going on,
right,
you know, pretty strong. So, yeah, I have a good connection and a nostalgic connection with the actual music and the film itself and the books.
Right.
So, yeah, I like this one. I think it's a really good one.
Are there any particular tracks that you like?
So, yes, I do have specific tracks that I like. Of course, I like Hedwig's theme as well as Harry's Wondrous World and even... Christmas at Hogwarts, I think, is a really fun little change of pace for the movie and for the soundtrack itself too. It has a little
Diagon
bit...
Alley too.
Yeah, right? Diagon Alley is a really good one as well. That one is kind of a change of pace, but again, all of them kind of give you a very specific image and
specific feel.
Yeah, and they really do stand on their own as far as giving you the feeling that you need to get into the zone, into the wondrous world of Harry Potter. The wondrous wizarding world of Harry Potter.
Well, for me, I don't think that the world is that wondrous. I am not a Harry Potter fan at all. I did grow up with the movies, but I've read the books after the fact because I wasn't going to blindly not like Harry Potter. I wasn't going to be that guy. Mm-hmm. I did read the books and I wasn't crazy about them. I kind of grew up on Lord of the Rings, so that was kind of where that prejudice might come from.
Yeah, just different camps, you know.
Right. But I immensely prefer the music of Harry Potter to Lord of the Rings. Mm. I have nostalgia for the Harry Potter movies, even though I don't like Harry Potter, because the music is just so drop-dead great.
Mm-hmm.
I love it so much. And I find myself humming these tunes all the time. And this is a score that I come back to a lot.
It's the John Williams magic.
Right.
I think it's just so much more succinct than the Lord of the Rings soundtrack.
Yeah,
Lord of the Rings,
it's just so much more long-winded. And I don't really have anything against Howard Shore, but it's comparing like Harry Potter to Wagner, really, because those Lord of the Rings scores are almost Wagnerian in scope, mm-hmm. because it's so much music. It's Wagner without as much of the Wagner.
Right. But but John Williams takes the ideas of Wagner, too, with the leitmotif type ideas.
Right.
Applying a specific,
but he's not nearly
theme.
As long-winded as
right.
Wagner.
Yeah,
that's
but he takes the good parts of Wagner,
right? And part of that's of consequence because you're not making a six-hour-long movie
mm-hmm.
today, or even throughout the 70s or 80s. That's not something that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
So let's move on from Harry Potter. This is another one, Star Wars Episode II. A love sequence with Anakin and Padme,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, I think that that's one of the most gorgeous love themes ever written. That whole sequence falls flat in the acting department, but the music makes it. So, for that, I will say George Lucas and John Williams, that is a movie I go back to because of that music. So, mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be... Everything has to be great. You could be one great element of the film, and in this case, the music, and I'll go back to it. So Minority Report is another good one. Have you seen that one?
I haven't seen that one.
That one's a cool one. We should check that out. Star Wars Episode III, Revenge of the Sith, lots of great stuff in there. The Adventures of Tintin. We just listened to this.
Yeah, I actually really like that one. I haven't seen that movie either, but... It was really fun.
Yeah,
I really liked listening to the soundtrack.
Too.
Yeah,
there's a lot of clarinet and bassoon and lots of sounds that you don't normally hear from
yeah.
John Williams.
Yeah, exactly. That was what I was thinking the most. It's not a very typical John Williams score when you think of Harry Potter, Star Wars, Jurassic Park, the big
right.
Spielberg movies.
It's a little more subtle.
Yeah, it's a little bit more subtle and a little bit more lighthearted.
It feels like something out of like a Wes Anderson film, almost.
Mm, yeah, I can see that.
So next we have I skipped a couple of these. Far and Away. This is a film I haven't seen. I've heard it's not very good. But that has some great thematic writing. There's lots of Irish influences in there, Irish folk influences, as well as just some really, really great brass parts. The horns, particularly. Far and Away is great. Memoirs of a Geisha. That one has a really unique sound because he's exploring this Eastern texture that he doesn't normally get into in his films. Because I honestly just don't think he's had any films where that's been appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
So that one is a really interesting one, and I think he does the music justice.
Yeah,
It's
such a complex thing going into that Eastern music sphere, right? That Eastern music, idea. And so there's so much that he could take away from it, and he takes enough where you get the idea and it's still appropriate and nothing is over the top or
right.
too much where it's
not gratuitous
insulting.
In any way,
right?
Or it's just like, oh well, we're gonna have this Asian flute sound because it's an Asian movie, where like he reaches mm-hmm. in and finds unique instrumentation to convey these Eastern ideas. So it's really interesting, and it's quite a great film, I think. Mm-hmm. So definitely check that out. We talked about Tintin already. We skipped Far and Away and Memoirs of a Geisha. War Horse. So this is one, a lot of Vaughn Williams in this one. A lot of Vaughn Williams and Elgar-type influences. Have you seen this one?
No, I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, I saw this one when it came out in theaters. A really British sound, but then the next one has a really American sound. Lincoln. A lot of Copland influences, I feel like, in there. I can hear the echoes of Fanfare for a Common Man in there. That's a really great one. And as trumpet players, we're pretty familiar with the repertoire in that one.
Mm-hmm.
So here are my two favorite Star Wars scores by John Williams, and it's The Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. I know that there's a lot of controversy about these movies. I will say that I think that The Last Jedi is a bold direction that both Fernando and I really enjoyed for the franchise, and the music in particular in that one is just so great. The themes in across both these movies, though, Rey's theme and Kylo Ren's theme in particular. Kylo Ren's theme is our favorite. Mm-hmm. It's so simple. It's five notes.
Yeah. But it's so easy to overlook. And sometimes people don't even notice it, especially because it's only a couple notes. And,
right.
You know, it doesn't show up too often.
Right.
But only every time he shows up in the movie.
Yeah.
But,
but every time they use it, it's just like, it's so menacing.
Right. It's powerful. It's impactful.
Right.
Just like he should be as a character.
Yeah, and it's because he's such a complex character too, it's treated in a bunch of different ways. It starts with all brass the first time he's introduced, horns, and then you have punctuated fanfare figures and the trumpets above it, and then as he evolves as a character, you'll hear it introduced in the oboe and even in just the full string section. And oh man, in The Last Jedi, that scene where Luke is revealed to be the Force ghost on that salt planet.
Oh, you're gonna have to say spoiler alert on that one.
Spoiler alert. It's 2017. The movie made like millions of dollars.
Yeah.
Like, okay, yeah. If you're listening to this podcast and you
hey, you never know, some people might have been
okay, someone might not have, but anyway, yeah, really great sequence there where the theme is stated with the choir in the background,
mm-hmm.
in particular. And then in these two movies there's some really great chase music, and I think I've neglected to talk about his chase music in general, but you know what I'm talking about when I say chase music. It's a anytime there's like a chase scene or anything of that sort, John Williams just has the perfect music for it. And it's usually something mixed meter, and when there's moments of loss of balance or like where the main character is in a tricky situation, like there's this tumultuous nature to the music that mm-hmm. is really attributing to the excitement and to the action there. So I think he does that really well.
Yeah, very Stravinsky-esque in some ways.
Right, and especially with these more recent Star Wars films, there's one track in The Last Jedi that is just straight out of The Rite of Spring, I'm pretty sure. It's really, really cool. I don't think I showed you that one, but that I'm going to show you that later. It's really cool. Some other facts about John Williams. I managed to ignore these earlier. 5 Academy Awards, 50 nominations. That's pretty crazy. More than 30 Grammy Awards and nominations. His chief influences, we've talked about a few of these already, were Elgar, Eric Wolfgang Korngold. That one is especially apparent because he wrote some really swashbuckling scores, and John Williams definitely borrowed from that tradition, especially with the Star Wars and Indiana Jones. That's straight out of the Korngold book right there.
Mm-hmm.
Alfred Newman, Miklos Rozsa, Conrad Salinger. He was the arranger for The Wizard of Oz, another influence on him. Definitely can see that with some of his more tuneful selections for sure. But with these influences, that's so interesting to talk about because those were the ones that were expressly stated by Williams were his influences. But we talked about Wagner, we've talked about Stravinsky. I don't think I've mentioned Richard Strauss yet, but I feel like that's also a big influence on his music. It might not be overtly, but I hear that in his music, I hear those influences.
Mm-hmm.
Some other pieces by John Williams. He's famous for composing music for the Olympic Games on four separate occasions. His Summon the Heroes is my favorite, but there's the Olympic Fanfare and Theme for the 1984 Olympics, the Olympic Spirit, 1988, Summon the Heroes, 1996, and Call of the Champions for 2002. All great pieces you should check out. He also wrote the theme for NBC News, The Mission. Very popular theme there. Yeah, it's pretty good. It's written a lot of concerti for different instruments and orchestra. So flute concerti, violin, tuba, clarinet, bassoon, cello, trumpet, horn, oboe, piano, harp. There's a lot here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost, it's funny to me because that's almost to the scope of like a composer like Hindemith, who wrote all these concertis, sonatas for all these different instruments, except I don't think in a lot of cases they were for orchestra with Hindemith.
Right.
But that's interesting there. And cool pieces you should check out by John Williams. We've listened to the trumpet one, and I've heard the cello and the harp one as well. So yeah, there's just a lot to dive into with John Williams.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch, but I think we can move on.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, next up is Justin Hurwitz. Very modern film composer right now. Also a writer, too, a screenwriter.
Born in 1985.
Yeah, born in 1985.
Not much older than we are.
Yeah, not too much. Not too much, but just slightly, and that has given him quite a bit of experience. So he was born to a mother who was a professional ballet dancer, but she turned to nursing after that, actually. Mm. And then his dad was a writer as well, so maybe that's where he gets that from.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you can see some of that influence. I feel like his music is, it always tells a story that's independent of the film, because La La Land is this story that, even if you did not have that film, I feel like that the music of La La Land is of this bygone era. It's telling the story of Hollywood and Technicolor, like back in the day. So yeah, definitely can see that in his music.
And La La Land is the his most iconic or most notable film score that he's done. Quite a big movie recently.
Oh yeah, it made such a splash. I mean, it was huge.
Yeah, but back to his biography a little bit. He attended Harvard and was roommates with Damien Chazelle. And this is where they really started to form their very close friendship and would start collaborating. With all of the film scores that Justin Hurwitz has done, Damien Chazelle has always been the director, which is a funny little thing about that. So
partnerships.
They just, I guess, are really close friends. And so they've continued to collaborate over time with each new movie. There's a new soundtrack to go with it. As far as his writing career goes, Hurwitz has written for TV's The Simpsons. In 2011, he wrote one episode, credited as a writer. 2011, again, he was writing for The League, the TV show The League. He wrote seven episodes, credited as a writer again. And then in 2017, up to this year, actually, 2020, he has been writing for Curb Your Enthusiasm. So a lot of comedy writing in there. 11 episodes on Curb Your Enthusiasm, credited as a writer and producer. So those are his credits as a writer.
Cool. And we haven't even gotten really into his credits as a composer yet.
Right. Yeah, exactly. This is all just extra stuff. And going along with the extra stuff, with his good friend, Damien Chazelle, he formed or helped form the indie group Chester French. This is just a regular old indie band. They formed at Harvard in their freshman year, and Hurwitz was playing keyboard and a little bit of percussion. Chazelle was on drums. It's a group that's still around today, so you could actually listen to some of their music now. It's super hard to find the music of the era that they were in the band.
Really?
Yeah, because they've moved on and had different members, and so now it's it's pretty hard to find the
still interesting
the music there. Yeah, it is interesting because it's that like indie kind of homegrown sound. It's a little bit different than a lot of popular music and other stuff going on around nowadays. Anyways, also while he was at Harvard, he was a member of the Harvard Lampoon. It's a humor publication at the school. It's pretty popular, pretty well known. That might be where he got his comedy writing skills from, or his love for comedy writing expanded. He's won multiple awards from major associations as well as smaller organizations. So we'll get into that after we get into the films a little bit.
Okay.
So most notably, like I've said, or like we've said, La La Land is the heavy hitter in the lineup. That was a 2014 movie. The predecessor to that is actually a student film that Hurwitz and Chazelle had worked on together. And that one is called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. And like I said, that was a student film. There's actually a lot of music is kind of originally there that would later be used again in La La Land.
Oh, yeah. Like, some of those themes were just cut and paste.
Yeah.
I thought it was cool, though, because it was interesting to see where those themes originated.
Right.
And how he evolved on those for La La Land.
Right. So if you really do like the music for La La Land, then I would definitely encourage you to at least check out the music and the film Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. Because I think that it's a really unique taste and a different kind of sound. Because it's a student film, it's not, you know, the well-polished and cleaned-up version that La La Land is, but it's great on its own.
Right.
So
it's pretty interesting. You showed me a little bit, and I was impressed.
Yeah, fun black-and-white student film to check out there. Another one by Justin Hurwitz that you might be familiar with if you're interested in the music scene, Whiplash.
What a cool movie.
The 2016 film there. That one is one that I really liked and was really excited about when it came out. It was a really fun movie. I mean, not always too fun. It's actually kind of stressful in some ways.
Yeah. But yeah, J.K. Simmons stresses me out.
Right. But it's a movie all about jazz school. And so it's very jazzy, of course, like all of the other soundtracks that Hurwitz does.
Right.
Up to this point, he's done all these jazzy scores and jazzy soundtracks, and so Whiplash fits into that really well. Again, it's the same director, same little collaboration group, and they nail it for me. I like Whiplash, like the actual track Whiplash.
Yeah.
And I also like the arrangement of Caravan. I think that one's a really fun arrangement, too.
Yeah, it's interesting because Chazelle was a drummer in that indie band with them. And then, so the main character of Whiplash is a drummer.
Right.
Who makes it into music school, and then J.K. Simmons yells at him for 2 hours, basically.
Right. Yeah, well, and the movie is based on Chazelle's experience in band and playing drums and stuff. So.
Right.
It's a loose interpretation, I guess, you know, an artful interpretation. And then, so the most recent film by Hurwitz is actually the film First Man. It was a 2018 film. This one is where we start to move away from the jazz. This one is a much more sci-fi type score, and it's a very, I guess, ethereal type sounding score. So that one's another fun one there. But definitely a hard left turn from La La Land, Whiplash, Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench.
Right.
It's a very, very big difference there. So some of the awards that he's won for these, because there's only four films for Justin Hurwitz, but four kind of big films that either did well or were important to shaping the rest of they were important to shaping the other scores.
And La La Land is the revitalization of musicals, basically, on the big screen.
Yeah,
I think that's a big thing, because at least in terms of original films, right? Because you've had some remakes up until this point. Les Mis was a remake, but then La La Land is this original thing that came on the scene and was so popular. So then it spawned things like The Greatest Showman, and I'm sure many others. I'm sure that Damien and Justin are not done doing this kind of movie.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, I think there will be more to come. But as far as how La La Land did, it won 2 Academy Awards. It won 2 Golden Globe Awards. It won a BAFTA Award. And it won 2 Grammy Awards. Most of those are for either the best original score or for the best original song, some of them for both. So they really nailed it on La La Land, and that's why that's a soundtrack that I go back to a lot. I'll binge on that one one album, you know, that one soundtrack.
Mia and Sebastian's theme alone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just very, very good, and it's just so catchy too. It's the melodies and the themes are just so catchy and well arranged and well orchestrated.
Oh yeah.
To give you the whole experience just from the music. Yeah, I mean, it's such a pivotal part in the movie, but you know, you could just listen to the soundtrack and get most of it. So the visuals are just enhancing the music, and the music is just enhancing the visuals.
Yeah, and I think they nailed it in all departments there.
Mm-hmm. And we've got another award, too, for the more recent film First Man, which won a Golden Globe Award for Best Original Score. So, you know, another worthy one to check out, even though it's so different than La La Land. It is definitely very cool and got the attention of the Golden Globes. So
yeah, so this is an exciting partnership. This could be one of the big ones, like John Williams, Steven Spielberg. This could be one to look out for sure. Everything they've done is just such consistent quality.
Oh yeah, definitely. All right, well, I think that wraps up Justin Hurwitz. Let's move on to our next soundtrack writer, composer.
Yeah, so the next composer on our list is Elmer Bernstein. This is one of the ones that I brought. And to clarify, so John Williams is composer that I brought in today. Justin Hurwitz is one that Fernando brought in.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm bringing in Elmer Bernstein for the next one. Born in 1922, passed away, unfortunately, in 2004. Composer, conductor, pianist, all of it. So attended New York University, enlisted in the Army Air Corps in 1942, not dissimilar to John Williams there. He arranged and composed music for the Armed Forces Radio Service. Sound familiar? John Williams did something very similar. And he becomes initially famous for his score for The Man with the Golden Arm. That's a really cool track. Really, really jazzy, and there's this interesting section in there with the with some like double time stuff in the drums, but the rest of the orchestra stays in one groove. It's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I'm getting sidetracked here. He studied with Aaron Copland and Roger Sessions. Really interesting there. And I see that influence in all of his music, because he does a lot of jazzy type stuff for the 50s and 60s that's just starting to be pioneered in film. You're hearing some of those sounds in On the Waterfront and West Side Story with Leonard Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
But with Elmer Bernstein, he's starting to do this a little bit more and takes it a little bit further. So he utilized all these jazz and contemporary and romantic type sounds in his scores, and lots of variety, westerns, action films, later some comedies like The Airplane, and then some more intimate adult dramas. And then, so in terms of his partnerships, he didn't really have a big career-long partnership like John Williams or Justin Hurwitz. More so, like a couple films here and there. Martin Scorsese, Francis Ford Coppola, some big names there. He had 14 Academy Award nominations. His final for his last film, Far From Heaven, in 2002. He was a big proponent of fellow film composers' rights to copyrights and incomes for their works, which is great. I think that's great, but that makes it so we unfortunately can't play any of this music for you today. Mm-hmm. So maybe someday. Some great scores by Elmer Bernstein. We have The Man with the Golden Arm, mentioned before, jazz influence there. Then The Ten Commandments, a lot more of that classic film sound. Very recognizable from the golden age of films. Lots of really great themes there. Rousing strings, great brass melodic lines. The Magnificent Seven is probably one of his most iconic. Mm-hmm. That is so well known and just so tuneful and so fun.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't say I know all of the films on his list, but I definitely know this one and am familiar with the music.
And you know To Kill a Mockingbird as well, another yeah. really iconic one, which is the next one I'll talk about. Just from the opening, turn on the Spotify album for To Kill a Mockingbird and you'll be hooked in the first three notes. It's so great. Such a great melody and so simple. And then the orchestration is just so transparent and so classic sounding. I cannot get enough of To Kill a Mockingbird. The Great Escape is another very iconic one, that iconic march. You might not have seen the movie if you're a little younger, but you have heard the theme somewhere, I guarantee you. True Grit, pretty famous. Airplane. This one's an interesting one because this is released 5 years after Jaws, and this one's a comedy, but it opens up with direct quotes from the Jaws theme from John Williams. So that one gave us a little bit of a laugh we listened to. There might be more there, but we haven't seen the movie.
Oh, I've seen the movie. I haven't seen it in a while.
You haven't?
Yeah.
Oh, you have? Wow. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, but I have seen the movie.
Okay, yeah. That's one I'll have to check out then. Ghostbusters. Hey, that's a fun score. It's pretty minimal, actually. It's not, like, I don't feel like it's as present as some of his other film scores, but those themes are memorable, and they're fun.
Yeah.
And I just love Ghostbusters, so... He did an arrangement of Bernard Herrmann's original score for Cape Fear in 1991 when he did this partnership with... Yeah, it was Martin Scorsese. He did a partnership there to do a remake of Cape Fear. Then his final score, Far From Heaven, is really, really beautiful. That was made in 2002, and I haven't seen the film, but... The music is really beautiful and quite British sounding, actually. It reminds me a lot of Vaughan Williams, so that's that's an interesting thread. There's a lot of scores on this list that remind me of British composers. Which
yeah,
is interesting.
Maybe you just had British composers on the mind, on the brain.
I think I almost always do.
Yeah.
Some other interesting pieces by him outside of the film genre. He wrote a concerto for guitar and orchestra. Thought that was interesting. He wrote the Fanfare for the Hollywood Bowl in 2004. That was the year he passed away. But the concerto for guitar and orchestra interests me because that does not sound like something that is typical of his music. So definitely want to check that one out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is pretty uncommon to have guitar and orchestra, even though it's such a common instrument. It's funny. Funny the way that works.
I think overall with Elmer Bernstein, the big thing is that he's versatile. He's very, very versatile. He's a very introspective composer. I watched a lot of interviews preceding this, and he's very, his process is very self-reflective. He's doing a lot to make sure that he's being fresh and original with his scores. So definitely a great composer to discuss. And he wrote some of the most iconic scores of all time. And so I think that he's definitely worthy of being on our first film scores episode. Fernando, do you have anything else on some of his music?
No, I think I'm good.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the next composer you have brought to this show and tell today.
Yes. So my next composer is Michael Kamen.
Yes.
Michael Kamen, he born in 1948, lived up until 2003. He was another American composer, a composer, arranger, conductor, songwriter, session musician. He did it all, really.
All right.
And... He has a really strong connection with film, but also with TV and also with the popular and rock music scene. And we're about to get into that pretty hard. But let's talk about first his movies, the movies that he's written music for. So we'll start. Here's just a list of the most notable ones.
He's done
there
a
are
lot.
Some more. Yeah, there yeah. are some more than this, but these are just the most notable ones that have either caught my attention or are very popular. So... right from the top, we've got Lethal Weapon, Lethal Weapon 2, and Lethal Weapon 3. Those scores were all done with Eric Clapton and David Sanborn, other great musicians that you might know. Edge of Darkness was also with Eric Clapton, and that one won a BAFTA award for Best Original TV Score. We have Highlander, which is another score with another group. He did it with Queen this time. You can hear that music on Queen's album, A Kind of Magic. Some of the tracks on that were from the film, but the soundtrack itself has not been released on CD or an album or compilation form.
It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's so well done.
He also did the first three Die Hard movies.
Huh. Which I didn't actually know
yeah,
that.
Yeah, you might not know that. It's that's kind of an odd fact that I hadn't noticed. Some more movies here. We got What Dreams May Come, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which that one was with 12 other composers. That score was written with 12 other composers.
Really?
Yeah, and the score itself was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Score there.
I only know the main theme, but I love the main theme, the opening title theme. It's great. So I didn't know that that many composers worked on that.
Yeah, well, that was actually set a record for how many composers had worked on a single film score. What? Yeah, at the
Did
time.
Did they just spend all their least. Money on the music?
I guess. I don't know. So next up, we got Don Juan DeMarco. That was nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Original Score as well. Mr. Holland's Opus, which is actually about a composer, which is kind of fun. That one's very relatable, and it actually inspired, came in to create a foundation that I'll get into in just a second. He also did the score for Disney's 101 Dalmatians, the live action, not the animated one.
That's a good movie.
Yeah. He did From the Earth to the Moon, which is a TV miniseries. He did three parts of that TV miniseries, and that was nominated for an Emmy. He also did the animated film The Iron Giant, which I'm a big fan of. I like the movie. I think it's heart-wrenching, but also beautiful in its own way, and the music supports that entirely.
I second.
Yeah. He did the score for X-Men, the original X-Men movie, the 2000 version, and the TV miniseries Band of Brothers.
That's one of his most famous ones.
Yeah, a lot of people are pretty familiar with that one. So we'll go back to do some of his biography here. So how did he get to writing all of these crazy scores? He first started his education at the High School of Music and Arts in New York City. Now it is the Fiorello H. LaGuardia High School of Music and the Arts. That's where he started it all, basically. He started playing oboe there, and he became friends with Martin Fulterman. He also went by Mark Snow. Who would later compose, most notably, for the TV show The X-Files. So he was friends with the composer of The X-Files there. And while he was in school, he also formed a rock classical fusion band called the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble. And they completed 5 albums. And you can actually hear 2 of them still on Spotify, at least. Freedom Burger and Roll Over are both available on Spotify still. And those are really interesting albums because, like I said, this is rock classical fusion. And so I think that, I mean, this is obviously where he starts getting into the rock atmosphere. He clearly had an interest in it if he's forming a band with his friend doing rock classical stuff. So that obviously was something that was the start of something big,
right?
As I'm about to get into. But anyways, these 5 albums the New York Rock and Roll Ensemble rolled out with caught the attention of Leonard Bernstein, and so they were invited to play for the New York Philharmonic, which is...
That's so cool.
Yeah, a crazy opportunity for just, you know, basically a local high school band that had formed.
He's so. Like, yeah, I like these guys. They're all right.
Yeah, but, I mean, they did a lot of work putting out 5 albums, so I guess that's what you get for being... prolific like that in a way. After high school, he graduated from Juilliard, and this is where he started to get an interest in ballet. Now, his ballets are super hard to find. I was trying to find just a couple of the names, and even that was hard to find. So I did find some, but we'll have to wait a little bit for those. I'll tell you about those in just a second after we get through some more of this. He began his career in Hollywood doing the film music in 1976 with the film The Next Man, and that's where all of the films that I talked about before came after. He started with The Next Man in 1976. The other fork in the road, or the other path that he took while doing film music, was working with popular and rock artists, popular and rock musicians. And so here is just a huge list of artists and groups that he worked with. He worked with Pink Floyd. He worked with Queen, Eric Clapton, Aerosmith, The Who, Tom Petty, Bon Jovi, David Bowie, Brian Ferry, Eurythmics, Queensryche, Rush, Metallica, Def Leppard, Herbie Hancock, Tim Curry, yes, the actor, the Cranberries, Brian Adams, Jim Croce, Coldplay, Sting, Guns N' Roses, and Kate Bush.
Oh my gosh.
All of these fantastic musicians in their own right and in their own genre.
Previously of this, I was aware of Michael Kamen's The Old Moon in the New Moon's Arms, which is very different than all of this, and then his Band of Brothers.
Right. Right.
To and think so, there's so much more to him than just the film music career. There's all of this craziness.
Right. And so with all of these acts, he was mostly doing like the orchestrations for either live performances or just for the recording session itself. He would be doing the orchestration of the orchestra or whatever the ensemble was. And he would be arranging for that and orchestrating the parts, sometimes even conducting. So the most notable collaborations from this huge list I just said, he did, he worked on The Wall, Pink Floyd's The Wall. He worked on the orchestration for Who Wants to Live Forever by Queen. He did Edge of Darkness with Eric Clapton, like I said before. And then the 24 Nights sessions and live in Hyde Park, both of those still available online. He did the live orchestral version of Dream On when they were on MTV. He did Eurythmics' Here Comes the Rain Again. Metallica has a really great album, S&M, which does not stand for what you might think. It stands for Symphony and Metallica. Hmm. And that one is with the San Francisco Symphony Orchestra. And it is such a crazy cool blend of orchestral music and Metallica and heavy metal. It's so odd at first, but so engaging and so interesting that it just pulls you in, and it doesn't sound like either one specifically. It doesn't sound like heavy metal by itself, and it doesn't sound like orchestral music. It's something that is completely on its own and is completely unique. It
sounds like the future.
Possibly, possibly. So those are just some of the most notable ones. I also really liked the work he did with Kate Bush. He helped orchestrate the parts for Moments of Pleasure from the Red Shoes album.
Very cool.
And that one was also really, really beautiful and really...
Yeah, you showed me that again, one. Again, right, well orchestrated. It's really great, yeah.
Yeah, but that one, I just happened to like that one. I hadn't heard of Kate Bush before, and so that was a really cool one to hear, and I got exposed to new music, which is always great.
And so none of those were films. Is the crazy thing.
Yeah, none of those were films.
That's so crazy that he had such an extensive career outside of film music, but his film music is also so iconic and so great.
Right, so...
He's so well-rounded.
Yeah, incredibly well-rounded, and I think he just had a love for music, and especially rock music, but also film music, you know?
Yeah.
Let's get into a little bit more of the fun facts. He created the Mr. Holland's Opus Foundation in 1996 after he had... worked on the movie, and that actually supports music education through the donation of new and refurbished musical instruments to underserved school and community music programs and individual students in the United States.
Cool.
So yeah, that one's really cool. I thought that was a really important thing to add in there. In 2005, they actually created an emergency fund for these students and schools affected by Hurricane Katrina. So pretty cool stuff there that was very helpful for a lot of people. So a little bit of a philanthropist too, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Not only was he incredibly well-rounded as a musician, he's just a great guy, it sounds like.
Yeah. He also replaced Ennio Morricone, who, spoiler alert, he's my next pick, but he also replaced him for the film What Dreams May Come after they had made some changes to the movie. So that's another one there. In 2002, came in along with Julian Lloyd Webber, Dame Evelyn Glennie and Sir James Galway launched the Music Education Consortium in the UK. The consortium's efforts led to the injection of £332 million for music education in the UK. So that's a good bit of money there.
It's a hefty sum.
Yeah, just a little bit. And then finally, he also wrote for the Olympics, but the Winter Olympics. He was commissioned to write a piece for the opening ceremonies of the Winter Olympics when they were in Salt Lake City.
Oh, well, not the only composer on our list.
Right, yeah, John Williams and Michael Kamen writing for the Olympics.
Wow.
Among other things, like, you know, the whole bunch of films that they've done.
Well, I thought that was the only thing they wrote.
Yeah, not just Star Wars, guys. And so, what else could Michael Kamen possibly do? Well, he has some absolute music, art music, just classical music that's not film or progressive rock or pop. He's got an electric guitar concerto. He's got a saxophone concerto. And that electric guitar concerto actually was originally performed by Eric Clapton. So
him and Eric Clapton were
pretty close. They're good buddies. They're good buddies. He also had, like I said before, 11 ballets. Now, here are the name of two of them, the two that I could find. One is Rodin Maison V, and the other is Eagle's Nest. And Eagle's Nest was actually performed by La Scala's opera ballet, that which is a huge company. Like, it's La Scala is so big and so important.
That's insane.
And there's virtually no information about any of these ballets, including these two. That's, so,
oh my gosh.
Michael
came in, man. And additionally, he wrote The New Moon and The Old Moon's Arms, which is one of our favorite works probably ever.
Yeah. The New Moon and The Old Moon's Arms, if you haven't heard it, it is an incredibly powerful piece that has that storytelling element of film music, but with the beauty and elegance and extra flourishes that you can afford to make and afford to do in classical music.
Best cello solos.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Beautiful cello solos and just a beautiful piece all around. So highly recommend that one.
Absolutely. Wow. We spent a lot of time on Michael Kamen.
Yeah, we kind of did. So I think it's time to move on.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's go ahead and move on to my last composer that I've brought today. And that is Joe Hisaishi, born in 1950, still writing music today. Composer, conductor, pianist, quite a skilled pianist. He has a solo career, and then his conducting career has become more lucrative in the last 10 years. Born in Nakano, Nagano, Japan. His birth name is Mamoru Fujisawa, and he changed his alias once he started to get into the music scene, due to inspiration from Quincy Jones, an African-American musician that he really, really liked. Quincy Jones, translated into Japanese, becomes Joe Hisaishi. Hisaishi comes from Quincy, and Joe comes from Jones. So if you know a little bit about Japanese, you'll kind of know why those kind of reverse in that process.
Mm-hmm.
So he began Suzuki School for violin at age 4.
Very cool there.
Age 4 seems to be the year for most composers. Mahler, Prokofiev.
Yeah, Mozart.
So age 4 is apparently the year that prodigies are starting to find their step in music. He watched a lot of movies with his father growing up, about 300 a year. When I saw that, I was just like, what? That's crazy. Yeah. I can't imagine. I don't feel like I watch 300 films in a year. I don't think I break films.
I definitely don't break double digits. I mean, I might not get past 20 films a year.
Well, so in 1983, he began his most famous career, a long partnership with director Hayao Miyazaki, who is famous for his films with Studio Ghibli, which is an animation studio in Japan. These anime films are famous for being either mystical, fantasy-type settings, or kind of slice of life. Really heartwarming and pleasing animated films here. I love these films, and I love their music particularly. He begins with Nausicaä of the Valley of the Wind, which is interesting because this is very different from the sound he's known for. It's a lot of electronic sounding music that was popular in Japan in the 70s and the 80s. But you see little glints of what is to come here. Moving on, he scored a lot of other anime films besides Studio Ghibli throughout his career, mostly in the 80s. In 2009, he's rewarded with the Medal of Honor with the Purple Ribbon in Japan. That's the highest achievement in arts in Japan, so big deal there. Invited to join the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences in 2013. That's the Academy Awards, mm-hmm. So that's kind of a big deal. Some more facts about Joe Hisaishi. He just recently conducted and recorded a cycle of Beethoven's 9 symphonies, who he cites to be one of his biggest influences. So it's interesting. You can hear some of that in his music, but he has a lot of other interesting influences we'll talk about. He dabbles in a surprising amount of minimalist type techniques that you wouldn't really normally, you wouldn't notice on the surface, or even if you're just listening without a trained ear, you wouldn't necessarily notice, but there are some in there. He writes in modal styles compared to Debussy and Miles Davis in this one video we watched. I think Miles Davis a little bit more accurately. He, like I said earlier, he has an extensive conducting performing career. He actually has experience as a film director. He directed a film called Quartet. This was a film, I haven't seen it, but apparently it's a music film, and it's among the first musical type films in Japan. that's original to the country. So definitely worth, I think that'll be interesting to check out. Don't quote me on that, though. He has a partnership with the London Symphony Orchestra. He conducts and even performs some of his original music. He's a great piano player, so he'll often take to the piano. But not only his film music, but some of his more original music as well. Let's talk about some of these scores. Fernando and I are really passionate about these. Nazca, the Valley of the Wind, electronic influences, as well as Laputa, Castle in the Sky. That has a lot of the kind of electronic influences in there. My Neighbor Totoro, really great and innocent themes in that movie. That's just a fun one.
Very fun, yeah.
Kiki's Delivery Service, we just listened to that. That has a lot of European type influence in it. And that's generally a lot of his music. He has this give and take between the Japanese influences and more European influences. And sometimes it's a little bit more one, sometimes it's a little bit more the other. So that's interesting to note. Porco Rosso, 1992, that's a really underrated film and score. Really beautiful themes and some fun chase music in there, similar to John Williams. The Kid's Return, that one is not a Studio Ghibli film, but that has a really great score you should check out. Princess Mononoke has some of the most emotional and gorgeous themes that I have ever listened to in any film. It's so well done. It's so great. And I think I showed you the main theme from that movie a few weeks ago, and we just both sat there in just awe. It brings tears to my eyes, honestly. It's such a gorgeous theme, and it's not just the one main theme. All of the themes in that movie are nearly perfect. For sure.
That whole movie is nearly perfect.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a great film. Kikujiro is one of the live action films he did in 1999. That's a fun one. That has a really fun theme that starts with the string pizzicatos and then evolves into this completely different sound with the solo piano with Joe Hisaishi on the piano, and then the strings and the woodwinds, just these beautiful lush melodies over top. So gorgeous. One of my favorites. Spirited Away is a special one for me. That's one of my favorite childhood films. I owned it on VHS, and me and my sister would watch it all the time. We'd be on car trips, and that would be the movie that we would put in the VCR. We were so in love with that movie. It's these gorgeous chordal and quintal harmonies to open up the first track of the film, and it just brings you into this magical world, and is such great music. The Tale of Princess Kaguya in 2014 is another great one. That's really original. A lot of Eastern Asian influences in that film, so definitely check that one out. And also really cool animation style. So some of his other works, well, Fernando, before we get to some of these other works, do you want to talk about any of these that you like?
No, I'm good. I think, yeah, all of those are really good.
All right. Well, sounds good.
I think you summed it up well.
All right. So he has some piano solo music, some of it with orchestra, some of it without. His early album, I'm going to butcher this, but it's spelled MKWAJU. Mkwaju?
Who knows if it's supposed to be pronounced like that at all?
I don't know, but I think it's a translation here. But there's a remaster of the first track on this with the London Symphony, and it is great. It is so gorgeous. And he has a lot of other solo piano music that's worth checking out because he's quite the talented composer and pianist. We watched a really interesting video about what makes his music so nostalgic and vulnerable sounding and emotional. Really, it comes down to a lot of the theory of it too, because he has this really expert use of modes as well as traditional Japanese music theory, where they have these combinations of scales that we don't hear as much in the West. And he uses those influences combined with the influences of European music to make this really unique and familiar, but still adventurous and nostalgic sounding.
Yeah,
music.
It's still very distinct to Japanese music, I think.
Absolutely.
It's very, very Japanese and original in its own way, but also familiar in an odd way,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no, I totally agree there. It's such great music. He has some really interesting influences in the in here, though, because I mentioned Beethoven, but he also cites Berg, Webern, Schoenberg, and Xenakis as some of his influences.
Right. Which... some serialist composers.
Yeah, so that's a big deal to him. And, well, his music's really beautiful, so maybe we should listen to more of those composers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Absolutely. This is a composer I just kind of blaze through because I'm so passionate about his music. Him and John Williams are my two favorite film composers, I would say. And I would say that these composers, really everyone we've discussed today, deserve to be talked about alongside your Beethovens and your Mozarts and your Mahlers and Prokofievs, because they're great working musicians just like they were.
Mm-hmm.
They just happen to be in our time for the most part.
Right. And they might be regarded similarly, you know, in the future.
Only time will tell. Right. I mean, I can't imagine their music won't stand the test of time, though.
Yeah.
It's really just such timeless music.
Mm-hmm. Who knows?
All right, Fernando, I've rambled about Joe Hisaishi for too long. Let's talk about your last composer.
That's right. Well, speaking of timeless sounds and timeless composers, I think we have one right here. Ennio Morricone. Who recently passed away in July of this year. But,
so sad.
Yeah, but was born in 1928. He was a composer, conductor, and he played the trumpet, actually.
All right.
A fellow trumpeter here. So he attended the Conservatorio di Santa Cecilia in Italy, where he received his trumpet diploma in 1946, and in 1954, he received his diploma in composition. And then in the late 50s, he wrote his first concert works. That's where he started to really started to compose in the late 1950s. And after that, he also started to work as an arranger for RAI, which is an Italian broadcasting company, and RCA Italy. He also started his career as a film music composer in 1961 with Il Federale, the film Il Federale, directed by Luciano Salce. And since then, he has scored over 450 films, working with many Italian and international directors. Most notably, he's worked with Sergio Leone, and that's the one. That's the collaboration that is the really big one that is really well known. And similar to Justin Hurwitz and Damien Chazelle or John Williams and Steven Spielberg.
Right, yeah. Joe Hisaishi and Hayao Miyazaki.
Right. There's always, I guess, when you find a good composer, directors seem to hang on to them for a while.
It's the rule of twos. It's the Star Wars.
So, in 2001, Morricone began a period of intense concert activity. He was conducting his film music and concert works for orchestra and polyphonic choir. With more than 100 concerts across Europe, Asia, the U.S., Central and South America, a whole bunch of touring there. In November of 2013, he began a world tour to coincide with the 50th anniversary of his film music career and performed in locations such as the Crocus City Hall in Moscow, Santiago, in Chile, Berlin, in Germany, and Budapest, which is in Hungary. But yeah, this is all well after he had composed for, like I said, 450 films.
Wow.
A lot of Westerns, obviously. He's obviously most well known for doing spaghetti Westerns, which are just Westerns directed by Italian directors.
I think we have the two composers that have composed the most iconic Western scores, Elmer Bernstein and then Ennio Morricone.
Yeah, probably, really.
I think that these are two of the most iconic.
Yes, most definitely. So let's talk a little bit about some of the awards that he has won. Morricone has won a ton of awards.
Goodness, this is for a long all of his list. Music.
So I'll blaze through this one too. He won the Golden Lion in 2003, the Honorary Oscar in 2003. 8 Nastri d'Argento, 5 BAFTAs, 5 Oscar nominations, 7 David Di Donatello's, 3 Golden Globes, 1 Grammy Award, 1 European Film Award. In 2009, the then President of the French Republic also signed a decree appointing Morricone to the rank of Knight in the Order of the Legion of Honor. He has 27 gold discs, 7 platinum discs, 3 Golden Plates, the Critica Discografica Award for the music of the film Il Prato, The soundtrack from the film The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly was also inducted into the Grammy Hall of Fame in 2009, while Morricone himself was awarded the prestigious Polar Music Prize the following year. That's all the stuff that he has achieved over his lifetime, has been awarded over his lifetime. It just shows how incredibly prolific and poignant and important his scores were to the film industry,
right.
Specifically, obviously, the Western genre.
You wouldn't have the Western genre without him.
Yeah, pretty much.
Really, I mean, he created this sound that was so iconic that people wanted to hear.
Yes, definitely. And so some of the scores that he did, just a few again, these are just the most notable ones. I couldn't name 450 any Morricone.
No, but I think this is a good list.
Soundtracks. Yeah, so we've got Once Upon a Time in the West, The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Le Professionnel, A Fistful of Dollars, For a Few Dollars More, Maddalena, Once Upon a Time in America, The Mission, The Untouchables, Cinema Paradiso,
Oof.
Malena, The Hateful Eight, The Thing, which is a sci-fi, not a Western.
Yeah, a bit of a taste breaker here.
And Days of Heaven, okay. Which was done with David Kottke as well.
What about these Tarantino films?
Yeah.
Kill Bill, Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained.
Right, so it
Hateful
seems...
Eight, too.
Yeah. So it seems like Quentin Tarantino had a liking for Ennio Morricone, and so he included specific selections in a lot of his movies, like you said, Kill Bill and Glorious Bastards, and Django Unchained.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And then also some of his music was featured in Wes Anderson's The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou and Clint Eastwood's American Sniper. That's a pretty recent film. All of these are actually very recent films, Tarantino and later.
This is such a great list, and you have like 440 other ones that are just I'm sure equally as great, and there's probably some hidden gems in there that we would never have time in our life to ever find.
Most definitely. And some hidden gems in his compositions are actually some of his classical works or non-film works.
You showed me some of these, and they're really interesting.
Yeah, some of them are actually like very abstract, very 20th century, 21st century in their music theory, and just very non-Western, or non-Western in the sense of non-Western genre for film.
I don't know. This one, the one for five bassoons and two contrabassoons, this one gave me a kind of a Western vibe.
Well, I don't know about that. So, yeah, we've got some chamber works, Totem, Totem Secondo, Totem Signale, which are bassoon-focused works.
He likes the bassoon.
Yeah. A whole lot of bassoon in those. But he also has over 15 piano concerti, 30 symphonic pieces, choral music, an opera, and a mass. All of that.
Where did he find the time?
I know, with 450 film soundtracks, and then...
and you got to think that each one of those is probably at least like 40 minutes of music.
Right. He
essentially wrote 450 symphonies, and then... my gosh, that's so wild to me.
Yeah,
and Michael Kamen are just like going crazy. And
they were busy
too.
Yeah.
So busy.
I think, all of these composers were super busy or are still super busy.
Right.
In some way.
Because Morricone was still writing music up until his death, unfortunately, this mm-hmm. year. And the music world misses him greatly, because I don't think there's another Ennio Morricone. That his music is... It'll be a long time before anybody approaches him in terms of his notoriety in one specific genre.
Mm-hmm. He's so important because his music is what you think of when you think of Western movies.
Absolutely.
Especially The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, that's one that I always think
that
of when I think
the
of
Western the Western trope.
Yeah, it's the Western trope. I mean, it has the whistle sound, right?
Right.
And all of the whips and cracks and all the things that go around the Western genre, Western film music.
Right.
So it's definitely gonna be hard to find somebody that can replace or even add to Ennio Morricone's amazing legacy.
Right, absolutely. And so with these six composers, do you think that their music deserves to be a part of the orchestral music repertoire?
I most definitely do think that it should be included in the repertoire or in the canon, because I think we just said it best with John Williams and Ennio Morricone. Those are like those composers have staples that are always appearing in Pop's concerts.
Right.
And nothing that any of the composers that we've talked about today, nothing that they've written is easy. No. It's definitely challenging.
Oh my gosh. John Williams has some insanely challenging licks in his music.
Right. But I mean, an argument could be made for sure that some of the jazzier ones, like Justin Hurwitz, that one I don't think, you know, should be.
But then what about the orchestral stuff in La La Land?
Right.
That could be on this in the concert hall easily, I think. Maybe not the big band stuff.
Yeah, maybe on a smaller scale for that. But he's still an up-and-coming composer in a way, right?
I'm curious to hear the First Man now, because I haven't heard that.
Right.
So is that a little bit more orchestral?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but he's still early in his career.
Yeah.
So we'll see what happens with that. But for some of these composers, I definitely think so. And it all depends on, you know, what else they're doing, too. A lot of the, like, I think Michael Kamen fits really well into the progressive rock scene and, you know, the popular music scene as well as the film music scene.
Right.
So
you can do both.
Yeah. But he has a work that I think should definitely be in the classical music canon, which is the New Moon in the Old Moon's Arms.
Right.
So,
oh my gosh, such a great work.
It really depends for me, I think. It depends on the composer, and John Williams, I think, is a perfect example of one that would be included. Ennio Morricone.
Elmer Bernstein as well.
Elmer Bernstein, yeah. And a lot of the times, you know, orchestras play those, like, medleys or compilations or selections from, and I think that works great for pop music or Pop's concerts, and
right.
I think it also works really well just to highlight certain composers or to branch out from other things. I think you could do a really cool concert with some of John Williams' like non-film stuff, but
right.
also include the Star Wars medley.
Yeah, the Raiders March or
the
Far
Raiders
and
March.
Away or something.
Something like that, right? I think that would work well, or some of the chamber music from Morricone, and then, you know, you just do some of his film music, and it's a great program. So
yeah, well, I have 2 points here, and then we'll kind of bring things to close a little bit. But
mm-hmm.
my first point is, what makes more money, the Mozart and Beethoven concerts, which we love,
mm-hmm.
or the John Williams Pop concert?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The John Williams Pop concert is typically going to make more money with our local orchestra. I've gone to both, and it's almost always sold out whenever it's just a John Williams concert or it's a Pop concert with just film music. Audiences love it. It's so much in the mainstream now compared to something that's a little bit more niche that we enjoy, like Mahler, Beethoven, or Prokofiev, or somebody. But John Williams is going to draw crowds.
Mm-hmm.
My second point is, these composers are working composers just like the composers of opera.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, John Williams is like a Puccini. If John Williams lived in Puccini's time, he probably would be doing opera. And if Puccini was living in John Williams' time, he would almost definitely be doing film. It's a part of the repertoire just as much as Nessun Dorma is.
Right.
You hear Nessun Dorma played by orchestras all the time.
Yeah.
And then you also hear John Williams' Raiders March.
Right. Different context, but really, it's coming from a similar place.
Right. It's the working musician. Like, it's the composer. Like, they've got to write for what's gonna make the money now.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're getting this great music out to such a wide variety of people. Everybody knows the great themes of Star Wars, and
mm-hmm.
they love them, and I think that's great. I think that's magical.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting kind of counterpoint, I guess. I think the film music will get people in the doors. John Williams gets people in the door for a lot of orchestras,
right?
But how do you get them to stick around, right? Because you do want to continue to expose the people to classical music.
There's no easy answer.
Right. I think, like, some of the stuff I said before, like, continue to program John Williams, but put him into a group with other composers,
right,
to kind of normalize, hey, this is, like, you know, his music is just as valid, just as legitimate as Mozart
so
or Beethoven.
So have Mendelssohn, John Williams, and then Shostakovich.
Yeah, why not? And I've seen that at some, you know, at some orchestras. Some professional ensembles are willing to do that, and I think that that's a pretty smart idea, because
right.
if they hear something that they like in the classical music genre, when they're really going for the film music, then they might get persuaded into coming again to right. say, oh, hey, I liked Mendelssohn last time. They're doing yeah. Mendelssohn next week. Let it's me
like,
go.
Oh, you know what? Richard Strauss kind of sounds like John Williams.
Yeah. Yeah. So that really boils it down to, you know, programming is so important right. to any ensemble's success. And
I like that point a lot.
Yeah.
Because it's inclusive. It's not one or the other. It's not film music versus classical music. It's let's bring all this great music together. Because I love this music just as equally as I love Vaughan Williams or Sibelius.
So. Right. Right. I mean, overall, it's just orchestral music.
Right. Exactly. Right. And I don't even feel like we scratched the surface with film music as a whole, because it's not just orchestral music.
Right. Yeah. There's so much. Hurwitz. Yeah. There's so much to orchestral music or there's so much to film music, and we only scrape the surface. We only hit a few of the ones that we could think of off the top of our head that we really liked and that we thought we could highlight for, you know, a decent amount of time.
Right. And I think that this has been a lot of fun. But yeah, we're going to wrap up today for sure. But we really, really have loved talking about some of our favorite film composers. And we definitely want to do this again. There's much more film composers we want to discuss.
Mm-hmm.
So in addition to our usual classical music, and then maybe some other genres that you guys might suggest in reviews or emails, email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com if you want to hear something on the show. Fernando, do you have anything else for our great audiences at home?
Nope. As always, just send in your recommendations. We'd love to hear them. Just send in your thoughts if you have any, and we'll definitely read them. So that's it.
Thanks for listening to the Leading Tone Podcast. You can email us at theleadingtonepodcast@gmail.com.
Or you can find us on social media at The Leading Tone Podcast with no spaces on Instagram, and The Leading Tone Podcast on Facebook.
Thanks again, and tune in next Monday for more of The Leading Tone Podcast.